Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 149.5 with Tucker Merrihew on how to level up to $100,000 in profit per deal and up building and flipping houses. If you've been listening through these episodes sequentially in order in the podcast player like iTunes or Stitcher, you'll notice that this is not the cryptocurrency episode that I foreshadowed and promised at the end of the last episode. I've actually moved up the release of this episode slightly out of order due to the content we describe and talk about here, the COVID-19 pandemic and how Tucker and I are dealing with this possible risk as it develops in real time in our real estate businesses. But don't worry, it's not all doom and gloom. We get to the good part of the episode about 20 minutes in, where Tucker describes his evolution from flipping houses to building and selling million, $2 million, $5 million potentially houses and up. And we go into trend following, site selection, and how to spot these growth pockets in advance of the rising prices, which you already know that is one of my favorite topics in real estate, getting to a market right before the price action begins, ideally going up. Let's jump right in. All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, Tucker. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Cool. For posterity's sake, I think it's going to be an important little tagline here to note that we are in March, Friday the 13th in March, and we have the coronavirus hanging over the country and the world. And we are going to touch on that in just a moment. But for listeners, Tucker, who don't know who you are, may not listen to your podcast, be aware of you. Do you mind giving us the Reader's Digest version of kind of your career in real estate and how you got your business to where it's at today?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the first part of this business, I'll make that story very short, but I got into the mortgage game starting off in 2002. And then over the course of my time in that side of the business, I started buying some houses on the side, did what is now often called as house hacking. Back then, it was just called buying kind of a rundown house, living in it with your buddies, renting out rooms and fixing it up over time. And so that served me very well. The first one I did of that, I did really well. The market was going up quite a bit as well. So, you know, sometimes you're just lucky in this business, let's say, right? So I bought that house in 03. I sold it at the end of 05, and I made about 200 grand. I was 25 years old, and so I felt like I was rich. And so with that, I started buying a bunch of other houses, some of which I still own today. But I also flipped a few along the way. Long story short, 2008 rolled around, end of 2007. It was kind of the implosion of the mortgage world. At that point, you know, I didn't really love the mortgage game, but it paid well, so it was hard for me to walk away from it. But at that point, it was a lot easier to kind of step away, and so I did, and I started, probably November, December 2008, I filed the official paperwork for TTM Development Company, which is my company that I run here now in Portland, Oregon. And we basically went full time into buying basically REOs at that point. That was kind of the lowest hanging fruit, REOs and, courthouse sales. And we bought these houses, we renovated them, we put them back to market, and we sold them to generally first time homebuyers. And then in 2009, they had that big tax credit that came out. That really bolstered the kind of first time homebuyer buyer arena. And, we were selling houses in like a week, 2 days, 3 days at asking or over, which is a little counterintuitive for those people that kind of think back to that time period, which it was pretty nasty, you know, at least in hindsight. But within this little bubble that we were operating, which was buying these REOs and these courthouse sales and then renovating them and selling to first-time homebuyers, I mean, we were turning and burning houses real quick, and we were making probably 30 to 45 a pop, just one after the other, boom, boom, boom. And so things were good. And we just started doing a ton of those. Eventually competition, increased. The market got a little better. Not everybody was so afraid of real estate. And, you know, as that happened, we kind of changed our acquisition strategy from kind of that super low hanging fruit with low acquisition cost to direct to seller marketing, which at the time really didn't take a whole lot of effort to get leads coming in because nobody was doing it. And so we got really good at that. And eventually we also kind of moved up price point too, which I know we'll touch on a lot of this along the way. But we moved up price point. We started doing bigger projects, more expensive projects. And then eventually we even got into new construction about 2011. And from there, you know, we started building probably $800,000-$900,000 new construction. By 2013, we did our first multi-million-dollar new construction. And then fast forward to just a couple of months ago, we sold our most expensive home at just under $3.5 million here in the Portland area that was also new construction.
All right. Well said. It's almost like you wrote that out for us there. It was, well delivered. So you said the over ask price in 2009, what was it that was causing that? Was that the general market characteristics of your local area in Portland? Was it the quality of the reno? Was it your pricing strategy? Was it a combination of all that? Like, how the heck did that go on in 2009 when in a lot of the other parts of the country, people who remember back then, it was difficult to sell a property. Even with the tax credit, it did move the needle a little bit, but it wasn't quite over ask price, you know, flying off the shelf kind of situation.
You know, I think we were probably a little bit market specific, but not too much. We were doing a lot of stuff kind of closer in, right? You know, closer into the city core, I would say. I'm assuming that anytime you sell stuff closer into the city core, it usually moves quicker. But we were buying stuff that was very simple houses, like 3, 1.5, 3, 2 ranches, which generally around here for kind of your entry-level price points, those are the most popular style of home just because they're so simple. They feel comfortable. They're also very easy to rehab because they're such simple homes. But, you know, we just fixed them. They weren't great at that point in my career. I mean, we weren't amazing with our design. They were just, you know, solid, clean, felt new type homes. And we put them to market and they sold lickety split. I think a lot of it had to do with the neighborhoods that we were doing it in, for sure. But, you know, I think the one thing that we did discover is that, you know, there were kind of two markets going on at that point in time. One was the kind of beat up fixer type market or heavily lived in all the way to just completely trashed. And then there was the turnkey market, which was basically move in ready. Everything was new and clean. And those markets, you know, a lot of people thought that they were connected in some way and they really weren't. You know, we could have a comp on the street that was way lower than what we were selling, but it was kind of that heavily lived in to extremely beat up house. And then we've got this turnkey product on the other side of the street that sells for a lot more. And so we just found that there was a lot of buyers here in the Portland area that were looking to buy a home that was turnkey, even though there was a lot of kind of beat up inventory for much cheaper that was also on the market. So, you know, I think maybe it was a little bit of a local thing, but I know a lot of other guys that were selling houses, you know, fairly easily back then as well, that kind of focused on that same niche.
Interesting. Were these beater market houses like cash only deals?
No, like, so let's just to kind of frame the price points for everybody. Back then we were trying to buy between 120 and 130 and we were trying to sell between, you know, 199 and 215. That was kind of our sweet spot. Nowadays, you know, we'd be lucky to buy in like the 250 range and sell in the 379, 399 range for those same types of houses. So the market's come up quite a bit. But, you know, it wasn't like a super beater area. I mean, it wasn't great. It was North Portland is where we started. And then we did a lot of stuff in Southeast Portland. We did some stuff in Milwaukee and Gladstone. We were kind of all over the place. But we just really tried to find those ranch style homes initially because we could just get in, get out really quick. And back then you could rehab a whole house for 30 grand. Just because it was so much cheaper and, you know, subs would do work for, you know, next to nothing because virtually nobody was doing construction. And so you could get great deals on stuff just because people had a job. Right. I don't think we did anything amazing. It just, this market properties moved and they moved even faster once that tax credit went into place. And, I'm trying to think back to like the longest that we sat on a house back then. And it really wasn't that long. Maybe, you know, maybe a month. Tops of market time. I mean, I think we went, you know, multiple years without having a house be on the market for more than 30 days.
Would you describe the Portland market as a very constrained, very low inventory market and has been that way through your entire career? Or was there ever like an oversupply of houses that existed there since you've been doing your thing?
Ever since the bust, you know, there really hasn't been an oversupply of houses. There's one thing that kind of is at play here in the Portland area that's a little bit makes it different from a lot of other metros. And we have what they call an urban growth boundary. And so that urban growth boundary has to be voted on by a council to expand it. And basically what it does is it puts a permanent constraint on the housing supply unless they choose to expand it. So you can't develop outside of that boundary line. And so, you know, that has put a constraint on housing. So that's definitely a factor. Like right now, our inventory is running at like 1.9 months, which is a, you know, pretty low number. I know there's other areas that are a little bit lower, but that's pretty damn low. And back in the, I'm not sure what it was back in 09, 2010, but it was like, I think it was like four, something like that. We were still on the downside of six for sure. But a lot of that inventory was kind of that beater, heavily lived into completely trashed inventory. So that inventory level of actual turnkey nice product was very low even back then also.
What's on the other side of the urban growth boundary? Is this like farms out here? Is it just like forests? Like what is it that's on the other side of the line?
Yeah, a lot of it is like farmland, forests, things like that that, you know, they want to, you know, politicians and those that are on Metro Council, they want to try and preserve, right? So once they push that urban growth boundary, then they can bring utilities out, they can put roads in, they can, you know, record giant plats, they can build a lot more houses. So yeah, it's basically farms and forests. That's what's on the outside of it.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. So there's a couple things you talked about that were kind of trends. And I remember the same type of trends going on. And we had a lot of neighborhoods where a little bit suburban stuff, at least outside of Philadelphia, where I'm thinking of. You know, we have good school districts, you know, people want to live there. And right after that 2009-2010 era, we had that dichotomy, the two pieces of the market that were kind of that like beat up house, lived in, tired house. And then you had kind of the retail house market, and the retail house was turnkey. People wanted to move right in, pay with the mortgage and live there. And the stuff that was kind of beat up, that stuff was mostly almost exclusively cash sale. The inventory kind of ballooned for us. I remember that. And like no one wanted to buy them at all. They're like, hey, if I'm going to pay retail for a house, like I'm not doing a project. And I would say that I've noticed that trend kind of continue as millennials are picking up and buying houses lately. There's a lot of neighborhoods where I invest, and I'm in Atlanta, Chicago, and I'm in Philadelphia still, where people just want a turnkey product. And there's neighborhoods where you got that cash sale stuff and like it's hammered and they're not going to buy it. But the trend we did notice is when you get into those suburban areas where there was not a lot of supply, that supply has gone down more. And now we're seeing some of the retail buyers, you know, a few of them are willing to get in there and kind of put their stamp on it. But it's definitely a lot less than I remember it being in, say, like 2005, 2006, 2007. You could sell a handyman special, throw it on the market. Someone would use a mortgage or borrow the money, get cash, whatever, and just kind of snap that thing up. It was a bit of a feeding frenzy back before that. And I guess the trend with interest rates, and this will bring us to the current moment in time here. But I remember, you know, the real estate market. I got in 2006. So I only had historical context, you know, you have it from 2002. And then prior to that, we heard stories from the older guys, maybe who've been around. But the stories and then my study of history is like, I remember what it was like after 9/11, when the travel industry and the hospitality industry had all kind of shut down and no one knew what was going to happen. And here we are in 2020 and we're in a different kind of similar experience. But the dramatic rate drops by the government happened in both instances. And I don't remember what the exact number of months or years was before the 2003, 4, 5, 6 real estate bubble got into full swing. But I remember it was nuts and it started to turn into a frenzy. And that's kind of the trend that led to that oversupply, at least in a lot of markets. It sounds like it didn't happen in Portland. But we're kind of like at the seed stage, maybe as long as we all survive this pandemic that we're currently in. And there's a lot of uncertainty around how this is all going to play out. But like, you know, one thing I know for sure is that I hopped off the phone with one of my mortgage guys today, and he's like, I'm not taking any refi applications. I'm doing all purchase mortgages. I'm trying to help get all these people in houses, and I don't have time for refinances right now. Like, it's going nuts as a result of these rate drops. So, you know, what's your take? Let's like put a stamp in time here for history where people listen to this after it, you know, after the, this whole thing has played out, and it will look different, but they'll be like, man, that was their perspective. Now, I mean, what's going through your mind right now, Tucker?
You know, it's interesting. Yes. Cause I've been talking to everybody about this the last couple of days, specifically yesterday, right? Because time stamping this episode, you know, what is it? Wednesday evening. You know, I went to bowling league, and on my way there, I get all these alerts that, you know, the NBA is canceling their season, and the NCAA was going to do no fans at March Madness. And then they decide they're not going to do the tournament games. And then they decide they're not going to do the March Madness game. So it really was like a kind of an inflection point of like, it went from like, everybody knows that the virus is here, to just craziness. But then in the midst of that, we had kind of my own little litmus test where we had a house that we probably listed at the worst time in, you know, recent history, which was basically Wednesday night. And here we are, you know, Friday when we're recording this, and we've had between Wednesday night when, you know, basically shit hit the fan in terms of those things that I mentioned and a variety of other things, to now, we've had probably 15, 17 showings and 4 offers now to review. So it's a weird dynamic of, you know, you've got the financial markets and running one way, and you've got all this fear out there in the world. And then on the other side, you have another asset class, which is real estate, and us selling this turnkey, fully renovated, good product. Now, caveat to this is this product happens to be a cheaper house in a nicer neighborhood that's fully turnkey. So it's an easier product to sell regardless. But, you know, it's flying off the shelf, and we got offer after offer to look at. And it's not like we dramatically underpriced it. We priced it at market value. So, you know, I don't know. It's a strange time. I think your kind of analogy between, you know, the dot-com bust and what's going on right now in terms of uncertainty and just the effects that it may have on the economy, and then ultimately, you know, what will happen as we move forward, I think that's probably the best analogy that you could make. I mean, I remember I was sitting in this same office in 2007. It was August 2007. I got the call from all of the banks that we were doing business with that said that they were freezing the pipelines. It was like August 15th or something like that. And so this is when I was in the lending game. And, you know, they froze all the pipelines in one day. I got like 15 calls from all of our wholesale lenders. And then it took a few more months before everything unraveled, right? Because we basically said, okay, we can't fund this deal, we can't fund that deal, this one, this one, this one. And they're all purchases, right? So all those purchases fell apart. And then, the, you know, all the paper started to go bad that had already been funded. And then it just kind of unraveled from there. So that was a very different time. It just, you know, it was different for different reasons. Real estate was the epicenter of that problem. You know, the underlying financing, the mortgages that were being funded for, you know, many years before that ultimately were the biggest problem. But when you go back to the dot-com bust, like you're talking about, real estate was kind of on the outer ring, right? It wasn't the problem. It was just another asset class, you know, just like anything else, that didn't really cause that issue, right? That was like over investing in technology that wasn't quite ready to be invested in at that level yet, you know, back then. So I don't know, we're in an interesting time. I think that, you know, social media and the news, you know, the news is social media these days to a lot of people, right? But I think that has really caused a lot more, you know, mania out there than maybe it would have been if it was 01 again, 2000, you know, when they didn't have social media and everybody wasn't carrying a smartphone and they couldn't see, you know, all the things that everybody's putting out there, you know, on a whim. So I don't know. It's interesting. You know, I think personally real estate will stand. You know, there might be a little softening in some of the higher end stuff, at least for the immediate future, just because so many people have, you know, had a 20-30% haircut as of right now in their, you know, holdings, if they were in stocks or mutual funds or whatever. And so that's going to have an impact. And, you know, if they think that they're going to go buy a house and they're going to use that, you know, money and convert it to cash and then use it as down payment, that might, you know, affect the number of buyers in the market or how much they're willing to pay or just their buyer psyche. But the more affordable price points, you know, that litmus test that I mentioned at the beginning of this ramble, you know, that's about as good a data as I have right now to go from. And it went bananas as soon as we put it on the market.
Yeah, well, you were never one to shy away from listing a property in a crappy market condition, right?
No, I guess not. I don't know. Maybe I got something wrong with me, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic because, you know, it's like I was speaking at a real estate event a week ago, and I started making some mentions about what was going on and Corona, and everyone kind of had a blank look on their face. And I realized, oh, this is only because I got a little money in the stock market. So I have a finger on the pulse of the financial. And I do that intentionally because I'm trying to expose myself to like as much of the economic forces that anyone else out there would expose themselves to, so that I was feeling the pain earlier than I would have. Like back in 2007, 2008, I wasn't in the mortgage lending thing. I was flipping a couple houses. I was clueless, Tucker. I had no clue the impact of what was happening around me. And while there's confusion and some uncertainty around what we have today, I do feel like I'm a little more aware of sort of what's causing it, sort of some of the benefits that could potentially come down the pike for the real estate market of the lower interest rates. And people maybe, you know, right now it's like, I think the question with one of my advertising executives that I just hopped off the phone with was like, well, are we going to get like kind of a lockdown situation like after this, the national emergency was declared like a few minutes ago? I haven't had time to read the headline, but I know I heard that the president announced this. And there might be something over the weekend where we're stuck in the house and all non-essential businesses are shut down. So that may or may not have happened when people are listening to this. But it's like, okay, so if that happens, you know, what does that look like for me? What does that look like for my team, right? We do some direct-to-seller stuff, and we have to normally go to people's houses. And we saw a couple people cancel on us and not want to meet on account of the you know, the virus risk. We're trying to like manage that ourselves. It's like, hey, you know, like when does that, you know, like how do you handle that? And the people who are willing to meet now want to do the deal, and they're okay with it. And we're using hand sanitizer and not quite shaking hands. I mean, I don't know. Do we have to take a 3-week vacation sitting in the house here coming up? Or is this going to be like, you know, we sort of have business as usual as it was for the last couple of weeks. And I know one thing's for sure, like all of the listings and the activity, like we're getting showings, we're selling our properties. That's not the issue so far, but you know, I don't know where that leads us from here, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, you know, I was personally at a seller appointment this morning. Right. And, it was a land deal, which is why I went, but, you know, and my office manager who does all of our other acquisition meetings, he was at another one this morning. You know, so people are going on as normal. I didn't, you know, necessarily shake hands when I left. I did a little Corona fist bump, you know, with the guy just to let him know a good meeting. And then I went and, you know, washed my hands afterwards. But yeah, I mean, if we get locked down, like that's what I was discussing, with my office manager earlier this week. I was like, you know, I'm kind of flying blind here a little bit. I mean, I don't know what the new normal is going to be for this interim. And if it is that, you know, we're on lockdown for non-essential stuff, then, you know, we'll still be taking calls and trying to build relationships and talk to people. And, you know, people still have needs and, you know, life happens and they want to try and plan. And so, you know, we'll probably just, you know, take those calls. We'll, you know, try and build those relationships, figure out which ones are, you know, worth going to see as soon as humanly possible. And, you know, try and rank the order of importance for the lead flow and, you know, just try and address as quickly as we can. But, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting time. I don't really have all the answers on it, but I do know that, you know, stuff is selling still, right? And so for me, that's my bigger worry is like, okay, well, if the markets freeze up on the real estate side, just because of, you know, people's fear, and trepidation, you know, that's a much bigger problem than trying to figure out how we work a little bit more virtually. You know, in this people type business.
Yeah, you're spot on with that. And it's like the same trend of interconnectedness and internet accessibility. We have 65, 75, 85 year old. My grandma's probably like 89 or something, and she's on Facebook, right? And it's like, who owns stocks by age range? Is it the average 20 to 35 year old millennial home buyer who's like scratching, saving for their down payment, probably keeping it in cash, not necessarily, not across the board, but the average millennial is probably holding their down payment money savings in cash versus the 70-year-old who's holding, $3 million in stocks and bonds and any other security that has now taken a 20%, 30% haircut as we speak. And it's like, it's ironic that the same trend of interconnectedness, the speed of the Facebook news cycle that we now have, LinkedIn, insert whatever here, it's the 24-hour news cycle that we're on that rapidly has changed our psyche here compared to some of these previous epidemics that we've dealt with through history. That more affluent buyer certainly, I would think, would be more of a challenge to come out and buy a $3.5 million house. Are you modifying your strategy at all? So like this would be a good segue for us to start talking into your strategy of, doing new construction, a little bit of a higher dollar deal and making more money per deal as opposed to, multiplying the number of deals we were doing at 20, 25, 30 grand. Are you planning on modifying that to adjust for the risk that might be coming down the pike, or is it going to be business as usual for you? And maybe like tie that into, then we can like switch to the thought process behind those deals in the first place.
Yeah. It's something I've thought about, quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. I don't think it's going to change, at the end of the day. But I'll kind of explain why. For us, we're fortunate, and it's all relative a little bit, but we're fortunate that we have some higher price point areas where even what may seem like a higher price point house, when I say it on this show, like we've got one listed for $1.295 million right now, right? Which seems like a big number to a lot of people out there, depending on the market you're in. In this particular part of town, that's entry-level new construction, right? So, entry level is relative to where it is. And so it's an easier sell than trying to sell a $600,000 house in a different part of town. And so for me, really what we're going to do to kind of hedge our risk, because we're not going to stop doing the stuff that has much bigger margin, because, my business is built off of kind of, three buckets of revenue, on the sticks and bricks side. One is your wholesale revenue. Two is going to be, your renovation revenue, and three is going to be your building or developing revenue. And they go from, fastest to slowest in terms of actually turning a profit. And so we'll keep doing our wholesale stuff. We've just wholesaled one today. We'll keep doing our renovation stuff, that generally has a little bit smaller margin attached to it, but it's faster. But we will also keep doing our building. But when we do it, I'm just going to make sure that A, we're in the right area, right? So that, it makes sense. We're not pushing a price point in an area that maybe, isn't fully mature yet. And then B, if we're going to do some crazy stuff, which we're on the knuckle of doing something really crazy, and people would say, especially with what's going on right now in the market, I'm probably losing my mind. But, we're going to do a house that's a $3+ million buy-in, $6.5 million sellout. But I also want to see how things play out a little bit over the next 2 to 3 weeks. So I'm not just, going like a, kamikaze pilot here into the mountain. The reason why we would do that deal is because it is literally the best piece of waterfront real estate, that you can buy, here in our area around a lake, that generally has the most expensive real estate in our whole area. So it's the property itself, you can't get any better. And so then we're just basically improving a structure on a property that's already at the top of the food chain, right? So I guess to answer your question, we're going to continue forward doing our higher end stuff. I'm just going to be very selective about the lots and the locations that we do it. And that's how I'm going to hedge my risk versus going down price point and doing more projects, and hedging the risk with simply a price point adjustment.
Yeah, well thought out. I remember earlier in the session here, you said, yeah, sometimes I just get lucky. And I think that was in regard to the 200K profit on that first house hack or whichever one it was. And I think that a lot of times people will look at somebody who's done a whole bunch of deals, or maybe the person's talking about making 100, 200, 300 grand on a deal. Oh, man, he's so lucky. But the thing about luck, Dick Portillo, restaurant owner, he said, whenever someone says, man, you're lucky, that I want to punch him in the face because there's like sacrifice and there's risk and there was loss and there was failures and there was, missed things with the family along the way and there was hustle and there was, a lot of trials and tribulations to put yourself in a position to be lucky in those instances. So sometimes costs us, sometimes takes a leap of faith, like in these times of uncertainty, to go ahead, pull the trigger, you know, run the next ad campaign, go to the next settlement, engage the next. And it's like you come out on the other side, and if it goes our way, it looks like, man, you're so lucky. But like sometimes you're having to, you know, pull the trigger in the light of day or in the darkness of night here and hope that the shot hits the target. And about luck, right? So like I think that a lot of times, at least for me, I would hear these people say stuff like that. Oh my gosh, I made $85,000 on a deal. And this is at a time before I ever made $85,000 on a deal. And man, this guy is lucky. I can't believe I just want to do that deal. And then it was, you know, I made $120,000. Oh my gosh, I can't wait, 200, whatever the numbers were. And I would think it was luck. And there's probably lucky people, Tucker, in a sense like someone puts a band to sign up, somehow stumbles upon some deal and somehow makes $100,000. And it's like basically the lottery ticket effect type of luck, right? And I think like a lot of wholesalers, flippers, whatever, they stumble into that in their early one, and now they're all spoiled thinking they're all like that and like unreasonably expecting to make. And the next thing you know, they have to go back to the job being an architect because it's not quite like that. And for me, the luck comes throughout a large volume of deals. And because I am blessed to have a really powerful team of people around me at Diamond Equity, we did 223 deals last year. That was a lot of deals. We have like 75 in our inventory right now. Like, yeah, we're going to get lucky on a few here and there, but we're really playing the percentages. Now, when you talk about what you're doing, you're stepping up to another level. And I'm curious, you know, I want to know, like, for me, it's volume of deals, right? And is creating what people would think is luck. You're doing this, you know, 3 million by whatever you're putting in there and waterfront property. But there was this like philosophical investment development in your mind that must have taken place for you to pull the trigger on the first scary, larger dollar, larger risk deal that other people would say is luck, but you have a system and an analyzation process for making those selection on the lot and building. Can you speak to the background in that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think, you know, there definitely is some luck. I mean, that first house that you mentioned, I got lucky because that was the first damn house I ever bought, right? So that was luck. But along the way, some of these other ones, you know, the luck is through volume, even though our volume isn't anywhere near yours, but you do enough, some of them you get luckier than others, right? But in terms of the process and just, you know, what I go through in my mind, you know, it's taken a long time. I've had to look at a lot of property. We've had to do a lot of projects for me to be able to properly underwrite, you know, these higher end projects. You know, the high end is strange. It's a different type of beast in the sense that, you know, in the median and below price points, you basically can bracket a house's value by, you know, average dollars per square foot of comparables in the neighborhood, and comparables are pretty much any house that's similar style with similar square footage, right? When you get into the high end and in the uber high end, square footage is fairly irrelevant to comparables. You know, I mean, it's somewhat relevant, but you know, you can have the same house that's 5,500 square feet and they can sell for multiple $1 million apart. Right. And so there's all these other pieces of the equation that make one house sell for, let's say, 6 million and one house sell for 4 million, just for argument's sake, could be 3 million and 1.5 million or whatever. But, you know, those other pieces, those are the things that you can only recognize with time in the chair, right? Time in the seat, doing this business, looking at houses, and then also kind of growing your mental capacity when it comes to understanding desirability on many different fronts. One, the first one would be, you know, the location of the property itself, right? How is it situated? Where is it located? Who are the neighbors? What are the streets? What are the amenities? You know, just all those things that, you know, a lot of people, they start to understand that stuff, but, you know, maybe they don't fully. They're not a complete student of the game in terms of really recognizing, you know, let's say, you know, some people may not be able to determine that a flag lot is generally worth less than a street front lot, right? Or know why, or care to know why. But generally that's the case because, you know, you're not seeing the house from the curb. It doesn't feel as grand. Some people don't want to drive by another house before they get to the one behind it. You know, so there's kind of a, you know, a little bit of a factor in value that, you know, a lot of people in real estate just wouldn't recognize right out of the gate. It's a simple one for me, but, you know, it's something that maybe not everybody recognizes. You know, as you move forward, though, and the other things you have to look at is, you know, the house itself, right? The structure itself. If you're building new or you're renovating, you know, a big thing is floor plan. Floor plan is huge. How it lives, how it feels in the high end. I mean, that's how it lives and how it feels is pretty much everything beyond the lot. But how it feels, you know, how it lives is floor plan. How it feels is design. So you have to have, you know, amazing design if you want to hit that high end versus that low end, which is a big swing in price for that same house with that same square footage. So there's a lot of factors, but, you know, the first is location, the actual dirt itself, you know, how do I value that? You know, how do I rank that, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10? And then there's the structure itself, the floor plan and the design. Both of those are very important. To the end value. So I kind of go through those three things, and that's how I kind of get my mind to the point where I can say, yes, I'm willing to take the risk and do this project, because I've kind of mitigated the risk through those three factors, you know, going through that in my mind. And, you know, I've kind of weighed the pros and cons and where I'm at risk and where I'm exposed and where I'm not on any of those three things. And ultimately I kind of blend those together, and that's where I come up with the decision.
Yeah, that's it's interesting as you mention it. I remember before I had any money, and I went a lot of years in real estate, like not having the greatest habits and not doing the right things. And it took me a while before I finally found my legs. I was probably in the business for like 8 years before I started to really understand. And then by, you know, the 10th year, I cleaned my act up and had good business systems in place. And all of a sudden it was a sustainable model for me. But for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, I kind of struggled around trying to find my wholesaler, my flipper, am I doing the landlord thing? Am I, you know, can I get lucky on a deal? And I feel like it was like lottery ticket deals where I got lucky enough to like pay the bills, but never really was able to build a sustainable business. And so I had that level of experience you talk about being in the chair. But when I moved to Chicago, I moved into a condo on the lake, like lakefront, where you can hear the waves kind of splashing up against the garage, like right on the lake. And the Chicago lake is like living on the ocean. There's like 10-foot waves out there sometimes. There's like ocean liner-sized traffic on this lake, and you can't see the other side of it. But then when it came time for me, I was renting that one. When it came time to buy one, it was like, man, I need to live on the lake. It's not an option for me to look out the window and have just a backyard there. This is like a big problem for me now. And I ended up finding, you know, a condo that fit right a block down from that original condo. And I live there, and I'm doing the podcast here with the waves outside the window, but the desirability of the lot, the location now, that like act of living and choosing to live on the lake was, as soon as I saw the view in that original apartment, it was like, oh, I'm going to rent this thing. There's nothing anyone can say to stop me. And when I saw the view from the condo I live in now, it was pretty much the same thing. And I can now relate. Like, I worked hard and I did make sacrifice for a number of years, and I could have afforded to live in better conditions, you know, between years 8, 9, 10, 11. I lived way below my means and put everything back into the business to get to a place where I'm at today, which would be, you know, kind of maybe some of the buyers that you'd be selling a million plus dollar house to. So it's like, not until I personally reached that level myself and started to like understand the desirability of certain things and living in a certain location, would I be able to kind of put two and two together and put myself in that person's shoes who did make those sacrifices along the way, who put themselves in a position to get lucky along the way, who then has to be enticed by the style, the location, the usability, the design of your new construction home in order to sign on the line and buy that thing in ideally a 30, 60, or 90-day window. I did, too. So, like, everyone on the, you know, everyone listening into the show right now, like, one of the biggest reasons, aside from, like, being on your show, Tucker, and knowing your story, and it was cool, I've been to the website and perused the houses that are for sale and some of the houses you built, and they're like, they're really cool looking houses. And, you know, maybe they all look like that in Portland. I don't know. I'm not in that market. But they just look like well-designed, well-thought-out houses from the outside. You look at the pictures, like, man, that's, you know, that's like, they're really cool looking. Like, we don't have houses that look quite like that in the Chicago market, the Philadelphia market, and the Atlanta market. We do have other cool ones that we notice, but like those people aren't on the show, and I didn't feel the need to like invite them. But like hats off to the design team that you guys have working there, or you yourself, because you know they're just cool looking houses. I mean,
yeah,
what more can I say?
That. I mean, it's you know I can't take the credit for most of it. I mean, you know I run kind of a call it a family business these days, right? You know, my wife works with me and she does all of the design and project management for our projects. So, you know, although I've been right alongside her for this whole entire time, you know, that's her lane and I let her stick with it. But, you know, I also understand a lot of it. I have to make the decisions. But one of the things that you said, which I really resonated, and I think this really makes the most sense as to why I'm so comfortable in this market of doing higher end stuff as well, is that, you know, we built, you know, I lived well below my means for a very long time as well, just like you. But I also, I eventually climbed the ladder as I kind of stashed money. And we, you know, the last three houses, well, I've lived in five houses total in the last, since 2003, maybe six. But they've all been houses that I've house hacked or built, lived in, sold, and then moved to the next one. And I've rolled the equity every time. So that eventually I could have the house that I want now that's paid for and it's, you know, I can't do any better, right? And so there's no reason for me to move. But, you know, those houses that I live in, like the one now, it's not to brag or boast, but it's a very high-end house for a very high-end area. And so by building a house for myself like that and living in multiple houses like that, it gives you just more perspective, right? So, like, I'm not a guy building houses that lives in a little apartment or lives in, you know, a rinky-dink little house. Like, I fully understand, like, the desirability of these homes and what's going through the buyer's minds and what they want and why they would buy this one and not buy that one, because I actually live in the products that we sell, right? And so I think that does play a big factor because, you know, if you're living in these homes that are considered high-end homes day in and day out that you've built, you absorb so much more about why certain areas or pockets or lots or things are more desirable and why they'll pay an exponential amount more money for one versus another. So that does play a big role. And it relates to what you said about, you know, knowing the value and where you live right now.
So you mentioned paying an exponential price than more than the others, right? And I do want to touch on that for a second. So I always look at sometimes like I'm doing comps on a teardown in Chicago, let's say, and I look at some of the comps in the neighborhood and I don't ever check back a year or 2 years later and kind of see the trajectory. So I'm curious, like, as a developer, is part of the play, like, you're not necessarily like building the deal where you have the brackets on the square foot per comp and you're looking at the comps and the comps are 375 and one for 400 and one for 395. And so you build the deal on 390 and you're safe. You know, is there a similar process for that when you're doing the new construction, or do you notice like, oh, these houses were built in, you know, 2017, 2018, and now we're going to build this on one, but there's a great chance it's going to go for like much more than that. And we're going to like price much higher. Is there like some detaching from the value of the comps as you're like planning and executing a development?
Absolutely. It's, I look at the trajectory over many years, right? So you're looking at it, you know, if you're doing a flip project, you're generally looking at it as like what's sold immediately, right? That I can bracket and comp things to. For me, you know, I'm kind of a student of the game in terms of every single pocket in our real estate market. You know, not all of Portland, but, you know, all of Lake Oswego, definitely Southwest Portland, Southeast Portland, Northeast Portland. Like, I know every pocket inside out and backwards, and I know the trajectory of that pocket, and I know which ones have popped. And I know, at what point, I call it the builder train has come into that pocket, right? And when the builder train comes in, you know, prices really start to shoot up on the new construction. And so the game that we've played a lot is how do we beat the builder train to these pockets? And the best way to do that is to just know the game and know which pockets are poised for the next pop. And, you know, for example, the house that I live in now, it's right around the corner from the house that I lived in previously. And, you know, we were the biggest landowner in that little pocket for a number of years because I went in and bought up a whole bunch of land in that area. And then we built it all out. And then as the other builders came in, I slow built a lot of it because I let the other builders come in and I let them really mature that pocket. And that's how we made so much money on a lot of these houses, is because I just knew that it was inevitable that that pocket was going to pop. And we still own, you know, the property that I live in. And then there's another piece of property that, you know, unfortunately we haven't been able to build for other reasons, but the areas continue to mature. you know, we bought the lot for $475,000. We could probably sell the lot tomorrow for about $1 million profit. Now there's a few, there's some costs and holding stuff in between, but you know, I bought that lot because it had a lake view, but it was more importantly, it was in a pocket that was about to pop. And we've done that over and over and over again. So I'm always looking for these new little areas that, you know, as time goes on, as the market stays hot and the economic activity stays strong, the number of pockets like that, you know, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. There's not as much opportunity today as there was in 2015, especially in the area we operate, which is Lake Oswego. But yeah, it's just really being a, if you're going to do building and developing, it's about being a student of the game, if you're going to capitalize on that, right? And now there's guys that go out and they build based on, you know, what you can sell for, and they build and they sell, and that's what they do. But, and we do some of that too, but, you know, I really try and capitalize on, okay, where's the builder train going next? And how can I get there slightly ahead of them so that, you know, for example, we have a property that, we just put to market for $1.3 million. We paid $275,000 for the lot. Now lots are going for $375,000, bam, bam, you know, lickety split. But we got there just a little bit earlier, and that obviously widened our margin. We're also going to get a little bit of a premium for that house just because of the, you know, we do such a great job with the house itself. But part of that widened margin is the fact that we got there first, right? So, you know, you do enough of that, you get lucky, right? So to speak.
Yeah, and I would say, so I did a presentation on gentrification. I'll include a link to that in the show notes a couple years back. That's how I put a similar trend following strategy into play myself on lower price deals. And I've identified markets where even at the low end, we're seeing markets take off. So there may not be a place like this in Portland with a very limited amount of inventory you guys have, but for investors in Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia, there are these like secondary markets like West Philly, certain spots in South Side Chicago, West Side Atlanta, where properties used to sell for $20,000 in cash. Now they're $100,000 in cash, and you know, they used to sell ARV for like $140, $150. Now they're, you know, $250, $300. Well, there's other places where before, when that type of trajectory was starting 3, 4, 5 years ago, that no one wanted to buy anything at all there. No one would pay, you know, 10, 20, 30 grand. You could sell stuff for like barely $100,000 on the ARV. And we're seeing that type of secondary, primarily ignored neighborhood, a little bit more, you know, challenging areas that people typically turn their nose at, you know, reputation wise for investors a lot of times, especially when they're just starting. But these are like gold right now for first time home buyers because people can buy them for 45, 50 grand, 60, 70, put them in, you know, 50, 60,000 in work, and they're selling them for 170, 175,000, 165. And we've noticed that same kind of trend taking place on that like lower priced, previously ignored pocket of the market that, you know, is turned out to be profitable. So it's maybe a takeaway for someone who's not ready to, you know, drop 450 grand in a piece of land and let it sit there. But like, you know, maybe there's opportunity in every place in the country, like I just described there.
For sure. I mean, just to give you the example, the one that I mentioned that we put on market at the worst time in modern history, right? I mean, it's a sub pocket of an area that we build a lot of houses in, but the sub pocket would be the price point, right? Where now you've got these higher end new construction homes all around the area. So that lower price point, existing construction, smaller home, they've got room to run now, right? Because the top end has now been pushed higher. So the, you know, we bought one of these that's you know, a smaller house that's on the lower end, and now we're pushing the price point of what people thought that could sell for because that has room to run based on what the new high end is. So you've got these little pockets within bigger pockets that you have to be able to identify. And we've done really well with that on our rehab bucket. You know, over the last year, finding these kind of sub pockets within these areas where the high end has run up quite a bit as well.
Yeah, and a lot of this may be amplified as the rates have lowered. And a lot of this is going to be demographically amplified by millennials who are buying houses a little bit late, but have started buying houses and are reaching those like prime earning years here over the next decade. So I expect that we'll see these continuation of these different trends, you know, into the foreseeable 5 year, maybe even 10 year future, if I were to guess and had a crystal ball. But, let me ask you, Tucker, do you have any books specifically on this, like last piece of the topic where it was like identifying the trends, you know, developing real estate? Are there any books that you happen to stumble upon as opposed to just like sitting in the chair that maybe the audience could like grab a few pieces of your, you know, your knowledge bank and implement this strategy?
You know, I, as far as like on the development side, not really in terms of what we just talked about, but what I can say that's what's helped me more than anything, and this is mainly just because I don't read a ton. I probably should. Although there is a book that I will strongly suggest that's not about development itself, but just about being able to navigate business in general. But one of the things that I do that for those people that maybe don't like to read as much is I play on Redfin a lot. And, you know, what you can do on Redfin is you can look at these different pockets and then you can overlay the filters. So you can see listed, pending, and solds, and you can do the solds all the way back to 3 years. And so you can see the trajectory, the changes. You can find where people are starting to do teardowns and new builds. You can find where people, you know, have been flipping and whether or not those prices have accelerated. And so I spend a lot of time studying the, you know, pockets of the market with that as my platform, just because I'm comfortable with it. And, you know, it's basically MLS data that's aggregated in from all over the country. So I don't know. I think that's more valuable than any book when it comes to, you know, redevelopment that's occurring and really learning how, you know, it's happening specifically for your market.
Is that something you've done like a video tutorial on for your podcast listeners by any chance?
Yeah, I've got a link to a video tutorial that I can send to you. But yeah, I've done it. Actually did it for a guy in Spokane because I had this exact same conversation with him. He's like, I'm having a hard time figuring out where the hell I want to be. And I was like, all right, let's do a screen share. Let's look at your, you know, and I pulled it up and did it. So yeah, I'd be happy to send you a link to that.
Nice. Appreciate that. I will find a way to make that available for the listeners too. So as we kind of wrap up here, our time's getting short. Let's go with the other book recommendations. Anything else that you think the listeners would gain value?
Absolutely. The probably the most instrumental book that I've ever read is How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, I used to be rather shy as I was a kid and kind of, you know, matured as I got older and whatnot. And, you know, my personality improved and all those great things. But reading that book really kind of, it opened my eyes to human interaction. And especially in this business or just in business in general, life in general, you know, really mastering the art of human interaction is it's key to everything. So if you can do that, you can figure your way through just about any problem in life. So
I like to ask this question of a guest, and in this case, I think, you know, I'll go back to, let's say when you were in the mortgage business and things were still good, right? So you're still making money, things are working out for you. If you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself, your younger self at that point, what would that be?
Crown jewel of wisdom would be focus is probably the key to getting farther faster. You know, I've always had a tendency, just like most entrepreneurs, to kind of want to build a million different bridges, you know, and try and attack a bunch of different opportunities to take over the world. But I've come to realize with a little bit older age, I just crossed the barrier to being 40 a month ago or so. So, you know, not that old, but I feel much older than I was back then. You know, I would say focus is the key. You know, really focus in on what it is that you want to do. You know, if you're in real estate investing, just like you said, kind of your challenge at the beginning was, what am I doing, right? Am I a landlord? Am I a wholesaler? Am I a flipper? What am I doing? I think you really got to focus and really master whatever it is that you're focused on and then add to it. Don't do too many things at one time because it's just, you'll never, it's going to take a lot longer to get to your destination if you do that.
Well said. So do you have a URL, some places people can get some more information about you, Tucker?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple ways. As you mentioned, if you guys want to check out some of our projects that we do so that you can see that, you know, we're real and we have real projects, you can go to TTM Development Company. It's TTM, and Tom, Mary. So TTMDevelopmentCompany.com. We put a lot of our, you know, cooler projects on there so you can kind of see what we got going on. And then if you want to hear, you know, what's going on with me on kind of a weekly basis and just some additional information about real estate investing, I think we've done a show about just about every type or topic that you can think of these days. I think we're on episode 300 and something, but it's called The Real Deals Podcast, and it's Deals with a Z, and it's on iTunes, Stitcher, you can find it on Facebook, Instagram, all that stuff, but you feel free to check that out as well.
Cool. Yeah, I had a recent episode on there myself. It was a good time,
right?
And the quality of the interview was fantastic, which is not always the case. There's a lot of podcasts out there, so that's you know, that's definitely a compliment that it was a good one.
Well, time
worth checking out.
we both been doing this for a while, right? Time in the chair. So.
Yeah, you're right about that. Cool. Tucker, I really appreciate you blocking out the distractions. I know you're super busy and giving us an hour and so generously of the information. I had a great time doing today's episode, and I appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate you having me, and you know, thanks again for taking time out of your day to do my show.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Up next will be the cryptocurrency conversation promised on the last episode between Gary Gilgan and I. You'll want to check that one out. And deal makers, I have cash for you if you've got a deal. I buy houses and apartment complex deals in Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia, anywhere a two-hour drive from downtown of either of those three cities. So if you have a deal, you can contact me directly using the form at reidiamonds.com or just replying to the email if that's how you found out about this episode. Accredited investors receive double-digit returns by passively investing in my real estate deals. For more info, go to fundrehabdeals.com. That's www.fundrehabdeals.com. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you once again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.